Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, we have three causes to be presented for oral argument. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. The Texas Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation versus Opal Petty and others from Travis County. Texas Gas Exploration Corporation versus Spoor Corporation from Travis County. And High Farm Corporation versus Jackie Self, Chief Appraiser of the Kaufman County Single Appraisal District and others from Kaufman County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. We will take a recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete the arguments before lunch. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Texas Department of Mental Health versus Petty.
May it please the court, petitioner will be represented by Ms. Tony Hunter. Ms. Hunter has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
If it please the court, I would direct your attention to our appendix in which we have a copy of the Tort Claims Act and the provisions that are at issue here, approximately 10 pages from the back of that appendix. It would have been easy for the legislature to write a Tort Claims Act that waived sovereign immunity for all acts, all negligent acts of state employees. That would have been a very straightforward thing to do. The legislature clearly did not do that. This court has observed in several opinions that the language in Section 101.021 of the Tort Claims Act is difficult to interpret. But beyond the fact that it's difficult, it still needs to be interpreted. And it is our contention that the Act intends to be a limited waiver of immunity. This court has recognized that in all of its opinions.
Counsel, are you aware of any other jurisdiction that has precisely the language that the Texas Act has?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any that has precisely this, but I have to confess I haven't exhaustively looked.
Have you looked at all?
Yes, I have looked at some. Many of them are quite different.
So it would have been easy for the legislature to have written the law a certain way. Wouldn't it have been equally as easy for them to change the law if they were dissatisfied with Saucedo or Robinson?
Your Honor, I think that the court is aware that opening up this particular issue is a difficult issue for the legislature to open, and that possibly there just isn't enough ability to compromise and come up with language that's any more clear, perhaps, than this. But I think that if the court will direct its attention to the language of the Act, it is clear that there is limiting language there, and that language needs to be given life.
Is it appropriate for the court to consider legislative inaction in the face of its precedents in interpreting the Act?
Yes, I think that the court has, in fact, in Robinson, done that and considered that there has been silence, but I think there was discussion in that opinion also that the legislature was not obligated to change the Act in response to this court's opinion. As Justice Kapil Garland wrote in Hopkins, given the nature of the legislative process, when one considers all the rules operative in the respective houses of the legislature that prevent proposed legislation from even coming to a vote, it cannot be contended that legislative inaction amounts to legislative intent. And the Act, if you look at Section 101.021, says that a governmental unit in the state is liable for, and this particular action comes under the number two portion there, personal injury and death so caused by a condition or use of tangible personal or real property. If the governmental unit were a private person, be liable to the claimant according to Texas law. The third court has interpreted that to mean that the property need only be involved in the negligence of a state employee. We maintain that the Act clearly requires that the use of the property be the causation of the injury. In Lowe, the court took the language from Section 1 of this particular portion, the portion that deals with the negligent act of the governmental official, and read it into Part 2. What I think the court in Lowe was attempting to do is to be clear that the use of property required by the statute had to involve some negligent use, that it couldn't just be the pure use of property. But in Salcedo, I don't think this court lowered the requirement for causation in any way. The third court relies on Salcedo and says that Salcedo stands for the principle that the property need only be involved in some negligence of an employee. I think that there's no question that every act that a state employee does is going to involve some property. If the property need only be involved, then this is a complete waiver of immunity.
Isn't the standard really that property is used in a wrongful manner, there's liability. If the property should have been used and not is not used, there's liability. Isn't that really the standard?
I think the standard
is... If it's used, it's got to be used properly. If it should have been used and wasn't used, if it involves the use or non-use, it's inclusive term.
It involves, I think the court in Robinson has determined that it involves a use and non-use.
How does this differ from Salcedo, where there was reliance upon electrocardiogram, where there was reliance upon the negligent act was based upon that reliance. It was wrongfully interpreted, wrongfully used. What's the difference then in this case, where you have records, both subjective and objective, of so-called expert observers that are employed by the state who make reports, and decisions are made, rightfully or wrongfully, based upon these reports. Some of the information may be erroneous. Some of the proper information, correct information, may be wrongfully interpreted. How does that differ from Salcedo?
Your Honor, I think that goes to our second point of error, whether or not the property that's at issue here was tangible property or not. I think the first and most important point is the causation issue.
An EKG report is a piece of paper. It's a graph.
That's correct.
It has to be interpreted.
That's correct.
And that interpretation, if it's erroneous, often, obviously, would result in a wrongfully prescribed therapy. Here you have psychological studies, behavioral reports, observations of experts. These are reports that whoever the decision makers were relied upon. If it's properly interpreted, if it was properly recorded, if it's properly interpreted, then chances are you're going to get a proper therapy prescribed. If it's not properly recorded or it's not properly interpreted, then chances are you're going to get a wrong therapy, a harmful therapy prescribed. How does that differ? You have records, basically. An EKG is nothing more or less than a record.
Your Honor, again, as I would say, I think there are two threads tied up here. One of them is the thread of causation versus just involvement of the property. The other thread, which I think you're asking me to respond to right now, is the nature of the property. There's another limitation in this section. It's not just the use of any property. It's the use of tangible property. I think the first thing that this court needs to do is correct the third court in telling us that the property need only be involved. I think this court has to clearly say that the use of the property has to be a cause.
You still
of
haven't responded to my question.
I'd like to come
Salcedo.
Back to it.
Salcedo, an EKG is not therapy.
The second part of the analysis then, and courts, because of the difficulty of this, I think have approached the same question either through causation or through the tangibleness of the property. I think the next limitation in the language of the Act is that the property has to be tangible property. And we have to ask, what did the legislature mean to exclude when it used the word tangible? Clearly, it meant to exclude, or not perhaps clearly, but arguably, it meant to exclude whatever is intangible, whatever is idea, whatever is opinion, whatever is judgment. And I don't think Salcedo controls on what's tangible property. I don't think that was an issue in Salcedo. The Third Court relies on Salcedo. Salcedo is determining whether or not it's necessary that the property be defective or whether just some use of the property brings it in under the Act. But let me address your question. I think that you can if you have to, and I think the nature of the case law in this area has forced litigants and and parties in courts to have to make these kinds of incredible distinctions, because we haven't given, courts haven't given meaning to the limitation. But if you have to make a distinction between this instance and Salcedo, I think the distinction is that in Salcedo, the electrocardiogram is a machine that's directly hooked up to the body.
The electrocardiogram. That's the electrocardiograph.
The electrocardiogram
is the record that the machine makes.
And I think the distinction, Your Honor, is that the electrocardiogram graph is hooked up to the person, directly monitors body signals that can be monitored. The property in this instance has no direct objective relationship in that way. It's not a mechanical way of reading brain waves or a mechanical way of determining a psychiatric condition. That these are all subjective, and that what you have in this instance is a subjective inference upon a subjective inference.
Excuse
you have
me.
Nothing more than a judgment call.
Excuse me, you have, what, some 51 years or so of observations, records, testing, both subjective and objective, I presume, included in this woman's records, some 50, some odd years, by experts who presumably are at least as expert as a machine. Psychiatrists, psychologists, physicians, therapists, counselors, you name it, they've all seen this woman, attendants, and who have reported, I presume, for some 51 years. Decisions were made in reliance upon their reports from both subjective observation and objective testing, presumably including mechanical testing. Testing I don't know whether she had an EKG or an electroencephalogram or what she may have had, brainwave test. Don't know entirely what's in the record as far as what they may have relied on in making their judgment. What you're arguing for, it seems to me, is a distinction without a difference. The point is, when the decision makers made their decisions, they relied upon the records over a course of 50-odd years, which is generally a much longer period of time than I think most heart surgeons would heart surgeons would take in determining whether or not to perform a heart transplant.
You know, I think, first of all, the injury is her, as we understand it, as it was pled and tried, is her continuing confinement, her institutionalization. I don't think the story of Ms. Petty is a story of failure or harm to Ms. Petty. It's the story of the change in the science, if you will, or the art of psychiatry and mental retardation, a change in the understanding of how you treat and what you do. I think if you lump 51 years together, you're making a mistake. I think that when Ms. Petty was committed by her parents to Austin State Hospital through a court of law, they were seeking somebody to take care of her because they couldn't handle her. And I think that's what Austin State Hospital did over those years, was do the best job that they could to take care of a person. And if there's changes in the diagnosis as we go, I think those changes are more reflective of a change in the understanding of psychiatric illness than they are in a change in Ms. Petty's condition.
Counsel, I have a series of questions. I may not get them all out, but let me ask a few. How does the provision on the no waiver of immunity for intentional torts play into this case as it reaches this court?
Well, as we've argued, Your Honor, we think, first of all, there's no evidence. We argued to the third court there was no evidence of causation between the property and the alleged injury to Ms. Petty. And the court told us it only needed to be involved, and we think that's wrong. We then told the court that this isn't tangible property in the sense that the legislature must have meant by use of that word. But thirdly, we said, if none of those, even if it passes those hurdles, what was really pled here and proved was the tort of false imprisonment. That the first question the jury was asked was, did Ms. Petty suffer injury as a result of her confinement? It was not injury during her confinement, but as a result of her confinement. perhaps miraculously, there is nothing in 51 years of her record that shows any injury to Ms. Petty. There's no abuse. There's no neglect. She bumped her head once on a windowsill. I think she had one incident where she and a patient got into a slight slapping, one slap each. That was the extent of any injury. The entire injury is institutionalization, the result of having been in an institution for that many years. If that's the injury, if confinement is what's being sued upon here, it's our belief that this is really a case of false imprisonment and is excluded by 1.1057.
Let me ask you about the mechanical nature of the EKG and the distinction. There was no allegation in Salcedo that the machine was defective and that caused the injury, was there? And it was the defect was the way that the electrocardiogram was read by the doctor, was it not?
I believe in Salcedo what the court was really looking at is whether or not some use of a machine. There was no allegation that it was defective. What it was basically, I think, in Salcedo saying is this was a direct message from this person's body through this mechanical means that said heart attack. And either the physician ignored it, misread it, or whatever. I'm not sure that that's clear in Salcedo. We're, of course, in Salcedo dealing with a case on special exception, not what, after trial.
What's the real difference between ignoring or misreading a diagnosis that comes from a machine and ignoring or misreading a diagnosis that comes from a test that somebody fills out or that is administered by a third party?
I guess it's a subjective nature, Your Honor. It's whether or not we're talking about something tangible or whether we're talking about an opinion, information, ideas that somebody has, a diagnosis that somebody makes that's purely subjective. I guess it's, in Montoya, you have the court making a distinction, a triage slip that is blank, and the person doesn't get emergency care as a result of that. And the court says that's not tangible property. And you have the court distinguishing Salcedo and saying a property is tangible when it records a tangible situation as in Salcedo, but it's not tangible when it records something like in Brantley, which is intangible, the order of a court. Or the ambulance driver is not liable, the state is not liable because the ambulance driver does not take a person to emergency care because it's his judgment that determines that it's not appropriate to take him in an ambulance.
This case obviously falls somewhere in the middle between those two, does it not?
You know, I think in all instances where you have an action, there's some judgment. I mean, if you have an automobile accident, clearly somebody made a judgment to make a wrong turn or to go through a light. But the court has determined that the injury has to arise from the use of the automobile. It's tangible, it's there. You get to the other end of the spectrum where you're dealing with doctor's decisions and you're dealing with judgment. I think it's at that end of the spectrum we have to begin to look to give meaning to the language of the act.
Doesn't your opposing counsel make some fairly lengthy arguments for that? In fact, the results of these tests were relied on just the same as to make decisions which harmed their client, just the same as you using an automobile to harm a client or misreading this EKG.
I think it fails in two ways. I think it fails because there's no evidence to show that any actor ever used the records in any way to continue Ms. Petty's confinement.
I thought on the basis of this record she was transferred from Austin to San Angelo on the basis of some documents. On the basis of some documents, she was formally committed instead of just in 1978 instead of... I don't understand the terminology, but I know she was under something that was kind of...
She was under a mental health commitment, and when the legislature passed the 1977 Mental Retardation Persons Act, it put into place a whole new set of due process, and it put into place an actual score, an IQ kind of score, that would determine who was mentally retarded. That was for the purpose, Your Honor, of deciding where the state cut off on the giving of services. And it was the first time they put into place a mechanical way that said you don't qualify if you score higher than this particular part of it. When Ms. Petty was transferred, the previous legislation said that people could go to state schools. First of all, San Angelo is newly opened, and the purpose of newly opening this place was to find a place for people who had been in the system for years and years and years and had no place to go, and this was to be a long-term place where they could be cared for, almost in a retirement sense. These were people who had been in state hospital for many years. There was very little hope that there was no family left. There was very little hope that they were going to be able to function in the world. And this was sort of a retirement place for them. The legislation in place at that time said that people could be transferred to state schools if they could benefit from the services of the state schools. There's no evidence to show that Ms. Petty was transferred solely on the basis of any of the property that's used in this question, too. We contend that that decision was made as a result of many, many things, and it was made for many people. There wasn't any statement ever, you know, well, this person qualifies because of this particular IQ score or this particular finding in her record. A court reviewed that commitment again after the 1977 Mentally Retarded Persons Act because the department, under the act, everybody was grandfathered in under the Mentally Retarded Persons Act, and you didn't have to release people just because they were committed in a different kind of way. But it said if people hadn't received the kind of due process in this act, then those commitments should be reviewed by a court. So Ms. Petty's commitment was again reviewed by a court, identified by the department as one that needed to be reviewed, and then reviewed again by a court. She was recommitted by a court. I would assume that the documents were part of that decision. I don't know. There is no evidence in the record that tells us what the judge decided, how he decided, what he looked at, whether he listened to expert testimony or what. That was never proved at trial in terms of what particular, certainly none of this property was ever raised and shown as the reason why the court decided that Ms. Petty should continue. But the records are replete with the fact that Ms. Petty wasn't able to function in the community without some assistance. Today, she has assistance. She has the assistance of her family that came back. Another part of the family came back in 85 and discovered her.
Let me ask you one more question before you sit down, sir. Did they argue at trial, did Ms. Petty's lawyers argue at trial, that the records themselves were defective or that defective judgments were made based on these records? What was their point? What was the evidence before the court and the jury?
They never pled defective records. They pled use or misuse of the records.
So you're saying that if an accurate electrocardiogram is misinterpreted, that opens the state to liability, or that opens the door to liability for the misuse of property. But you're saying that if accurate records in making this medical decision were misconstrued or improperly relied upon, that doesn't open the door.
I'm saying that the court has to carefully look at what the legislature meant by the use of the word tangible. And that if this act is constructed...
If you have a piece of paper with a graph on it, or if you have a piece of paper with expert observations on it, a piece of paper is tangible. You can hold it in your hand. You can look at it and you can rely on it. If all the experts tell you that electrocardiogram, their subjective observations and whatever tests they can run, which are devised by humankind, is accurate. If your experts tell you that by observing Ms. Petty's behavior and administering objective, subjective tests to her, this is the result. I not only don't see a distinction without a difference. I don't see a distinction at all. You've got a tangible record that you're relying on, whether it's produced by a machine or whether it's produced by, over the course of 50-odd years, a battery of experts through long-term observation, people who are certified, just like that machine is certified. I don't really see the difference. And if you rely on them, you presume they're accurate. They didn't argue they weren't accurate. No more than that EKG was inaccurate.
They argued they were inaccurate.
They argued that the records were inaccurate or the EKG was inaccurate?
The records in Ms. Petty's case were inaccurate.
Didn't her expert indeed testify that and I believe his name was Dr. Nelson, Jefferson Nelson, that an adequate evaluations might have led to her release. That may be the inaccuracy of the records, but he also testified, didn't he, that a thorough review of her records would have made it clear that Petty was not schizophrenic, nor was she mentally retarded.
I think that goes to almost your answer, Your Honor, and the fact that there was expert testimony from another doctor that said you could look at her record, you could look at Petty right now.
You're arguing the battle of the experts now.
Basically, and I think that's the very difference.
The state's expert argued that the records were inaccurate?
Let me back up. I think you could have the electrocardiogram printed in a textbook, and you could say, when you see this picture, it means heart attack. I think you could have Ms. Petty's symptoms printed, and you could have differences of opinion, difference of judgment as to what those symptoms meant. And I think you had that at trial. It was hotly contested whether or not Ms. Petty...
What did the jury say?
They didn't say whether she was schizophrenic or whether she was suffering.
What did the jury say?
The jury said that she was injured by her confinement.
The jury found that somebody negligently relied upon something somewhere, sometime, and all they had before them was those records.
And we have complained about that question, Your Honor. I think that it's the very problem we have right now that question gives us. We have hundreds of actors over 15 years, hundreds of pieces of property. There is no way for us to focus on one incident and for me to tell you when X doctor looked at Y document and made this decision, he wasn't only looking at Y, he looked at A, B, C, and F, and A, B, and C, and F were what motivated the decision. They were the proximate cause of the decision. It wasn't this X document. And that's the very problem we felt with that question. There is just no way to focus in this case on any particular actor doing anything at any time and determine, was there enough evidence? Were the nexuses between the act and the incident and the injury solved? Was this, in fact, the proximate cause of injury to Ms. Petty? We are floating around in 15 years of, oh, something must be wrong if somebody is left in an institution for 51 years.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to respond.
May it please the court. Ms. Deborah Heiser and Mr. James Harrington will present argument for respondent. Ms. Heiser will open.
May it please the court. In 1934, Opal Petty, who is seated in the courtroom, was committed to the Austin State Hospital at the age of 16. For 51 years, the state locked her up and threw away the key.
Why did her father find it necessary to commit her?
Because as an adolescent, according to the evidence, according to the records.
What?
According to the records, the reason was that she was having some mental health difficulties as an adolescent. The state kept her for 51 years.
She was diagnosed as schizophrenic, was she not?
Judge, the diagnosis was a bit unclear. Initially, it was hemiphrenic schizophrenic, yes.
Dug her own grave in her backyard?
That was in the record, although there was evidence to the contrary by people who said that was a myth that was perpetuated by family members.
But there was a jury in that case.
At the commitment case?
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know that. I don't know if they had a jury or a judge.
Well, the law as announced by this court in the White case in 1913, I think, required a jury in this particular type of case.
Yes, that's right. I do remember now the jury's answers to the questions. There was a jury trial. The state kept her confined even though their own records showed that Opal Petty suffered from institutionalization syndrome and not mental illness or mental retardation. The experts in this case testified about institutionalization syndrome. We spent a good bit of time in drafting the jury charge trying to define the injury and trying to present to the jury what the injury was.
Let me inquire about that a bit. This term institutionalization, you say that's reflected in the state's records?
Yes, Judge. In 1957, I believe, in the mid-50s, there is a documentation in her progress notes, which the jury found to have been misused and the proximate cause of the injury. The documentation says Opal Petty is a chronically institutionalized person.
Well, the concern that I think is raised in the briefs of the state is that your use of this term institutionalization is really just a clever way of pleading around the very clear statutory language that prohibits actions against the state for false imprisonment.
Mr. Harrington is going to address that issue, but let me just say that the evidence was very clear about what we meant about institutionalization syndrome, and I think it is confusing because of the word institutionalization. But what that meant was the poverty of the environment, not the confinement per se, but the poverty of the environment, the inadequate treatment, the continual existence in that setting not being properly treated is what caused her institutionalization syndrome, defined by our experts and documented in the psychiatric literature as a condition that renders someone incapable of having a sense of time or a sense of meaning or understanding. You know, in Ms. Petty's case, the expert testimony was very clear that as a result of that, Opal Petty developed a language disorder. It took us many months to realize that if you put things in written form, Ms. Petty can respond quite well, but she had lost that ability to speak and to conceptualize because she didn't use those skills for 51 years. The jury found that the diagnostic records were used and misused, and that misuse approximately caused Opal Petty injury. Diagnostic and records and tests are the only tools available in the mental health profession. The jury awarded Ms. Petty $505,000, which the trial court reduced to $250,000. The Court of Appeals correctly affirmed the trial court because the written diagnostic records and tests are tangible property. The controlling case on tangible property is Salcedo. I presented to the court, I'm not sure because of the shift in argument, I presented excerpts from Salcedo that I hope you all got. Oh, good. Salcedo clearly demonstrates that the written diagnostic records and tests are tangible property. In Salcedo, this court, in a unanimous decision, based liability on the doctor's negligence in improperly reading and interpreting the diagnostic record produced by the EKG graph. This court held under the Tort Claims Act, one, that some use of property has to be a contributing factor, two, that use is defined as employing for a given purpose, and three, that reading and interpreting are purposes for which the EKG graph is used and employed. Petty, like Salcedo, is a straightforward Tort Claims Act. In both cases, you have written diagnostic records. In both cases, the purpose of the record is for diagnostic purposes. They are used and intended for diagnostic purposes. And in both cases, the negligence is the same, misuse and misinterpretation, excuse me, misreading and misinterpretation.
Counsel, how many times during Ms. Petty's confinement was she was her case presented to a court to consider whether continued treatment in an institution was appropriate?
Ms. Petty was presented to the court in 1934 and then not again, I believe, until 1974, or after, maybe 75. At the time, you may know that we had a class action that accompanied this damage action, which attacked the whole practice by the institutions of not periodically reviewing those kind of commitments.
So on at least two occasions that you can recall, she was presented at a judicial proceedings, at which time there was a judicial determination made that commitment to an institution was appropriate. Is that correct?
It is correct to say that there were two hearings. It's not correct to say that Opal Petty was presented. She was not present at her second hearing.
Her case was reviewed by court. In a sense, is the judgment rendered by the trial court here a collateral attack on the propriety of the judgments of those two courts? Or if not, how would you characterize it?
The judgment is a finding that she was negligently injured as a result of what happened to her during the confinement. It is not an attack on the legality of the commitment per se.
Well, it attacks the fact of the confinement, does it not?
The mental health code judge has always allowed the institution to discharge a person when, in their judgment, they no longer need to be there. They no longer meet the commitment criteria. And the attack is on continuing to keep, not on the original commitment, but on continuing to keep her there.
Well, on the only two times that that you recite that she was presented, her case presented for judicial review, she was committed the first time and then returned the second time.
She was recommitted under a different statute, under the Mentally Retarded Persons Act, when she was at the San Angelo State School. Yes.
What kind of evidence did the court rely on when they made that commitment or renewed that commitment or recommitted it? Was it not the testimony of the experts that were employed by the state, relying on the records and their observations?
They would have had to have had, we don't have the records of that proceeding, but they would have had to have had testimony that Opal Petty was mentally retarded, testimony.
Was there another side presented, or was the court really confronted only with evidence that supported her commitment?
She had a court-appointed attorney, and what evidence he presented, I don't know.
Was there outside? Because we don't have those records.
We
don't know if there was outside psychologists or observations recorded or experts from outside the institutional context itself. In most cases, an ad litem counsel doesn't have those resources available, do they?
No, they don't.
They rely on the same experts the institution
does. That's correct. And it's usually cross-examination of the departmental employees.
The same mistakes in judgment,
correct.
The same negligent alliance.
Correct. The only distinction between Salcedo and Petty is how the records were produced. And the EKG graph is produced by high-tech equipment. We don't have high-tech equipment in the mental health field. The state seems to argue that if you don't have high-tech equipment, you can never have liability. The diagnostic records and tests are the equivalent to a mental healthogram or a mental retardationogram in this case. In both instances, once the observations are recorded, either on the graph or in the test document, the test protocol, it is the way that record is used or misused that forms the basis of liability and not how it was generated. Here the jury found Opal Petty, the injuries that Opal Petty received were approximately caused by the misuse of specific diagnostic records. Our jury question lists each specific diagnostic record, including progress notes, written treatment plans, mental status examinations, annual staffing reports, copyrighted standardized tests. And it's important that these tests included technical instruments, written protocols, an instruction manual, published booklet protocols that recorded where her answers were put and recorded and scored.
If this property had been used appropriately, what should have happened?
Number one, the evidence was that they used a Vineland IQ test. The testimony of the state's own superintendent, a psychologist, their own, one of the defendants, their own employee, was that the Vineland is never a proper IQ test. The Vineland is a social adaptive test. It measures how you are able to adapt to your environment. And there are questions on there that Opal Petty had no opportunity to have ever learned how you function in a kitchen. She never had the opportunity in an institution to use a kitchen. How you roller skate, how you do skills that you and I would do on a day-to-day basis, but a person in an institution wouldn't. That test showed what she was suffering from. She was suffering from the effects of being institutionalized. It didn't show mental retardation. Had they not used that, they wouldn't have initially diagnosed her as mentally retarded. Had they used the nonverbal IQ test, they would have found that Opal Petty was not mentally retarded. They used verbal IQ tests. The testimony of our expert speech therapist was Opal Petty had suffered a language disorder. The testimony in this case included testimony from her grade school teacher, her ninth grade teacher, that Opal Petty was not retarded at that age. The testimony showed by demonstration with a speech therapist, when you wrote something on the board, and Ms. Petty, we had graphic examples of how she could respond in writing, the nonverbal IQ test would have shown that she was not mentally retarded.
If they had conducted a proper test, then she would have been released
she would
from
have been,
the institution. Is that your contention?
No, she would have been properly diagnosed. And at that point, she would have been placed, because of the effects of what had happened to her, she would have received proper rehabilitation. People in institutional settings do get better. They do get proper treatment. And when they get proper treatment, they do move on. And that could have happened to Opal Petty.
Can your suit in any means be characterized as a claim for the deprivation of adequate state services in this regard?
The deprivation of services certainly went into the poverty of environment, but it's more the diagnosis that's at issue here, because...
Well, to be more direct, if the state had spent more money, is it your contention that they would have done a better job?
I don't think that the money is the issue here. I think had the state done, even with the existing resources that they had, I think they could have done a whole lot more for it. I don't think that this would have required, I don't think the testimony showed that it would have required an additional expenditure of money. Ms. Petty is not, in fact, the testimony of experts on both sides of this case was that the diagnostic records are used as the foundation for all decisions about treatment, diagnosis, and placement, just like an EKG graph and just like a CAT scan result. Ms. Petty isn't asking this court to extend existing law, but rather to apply the basic principles in this court's sulfato opinion. The state, in contrast, is relying on cases that are very different and distinguishable in ways that render their holdings inapplicable.
The state argues that if property need only be involved, then in essence the waiver of immunity is complete under the Tort Claims Act. What's your response to that?
My response to that, Judge, is that the state is attempting to mislead this court on that issue. The state is attempting to present to this court an argument that the Court of Appeals misread sulfato, and that they held that sulfato only required a governmental, an act, a negligent act by a governmental employee in a piece of property, even if it's not negligently used. The Court of Appeals didn't hold that. The Court of Appeals specifically says the negligent act has to involve, the negligent act which the jury finds to be the proximate cause of the injury has to involve tangible property. The Court of Appeals made very clear, subsequent to Petty, in their Eichel decision, that they were not extending sulfato. They said in Eichel that a list published on a piece of paper and an injury is not enough. More is required. You have to show that that property was negligently used. Sulfato says you have to show that the property was a contributing factor to the injury. There is not a single case cited by the state that holds any different from sulfato that the property, the use of property has to proximately cause the injury.
My question to you is, if the state argues that if property need only be involved, then the waiver of immunity is essentially absolute.
Being involved is not enough. Being negligently involved, negligently used, is enough. Under this court's unanimous decision in sulfato, that is enough.
It must be the proximate cause of the injury?
I don't believe that that issue is before this court, and we have submitted, and I will answer your question, we have submitted a supplemental brief this morning. The state raised that proximate cause issue for the very first time in their motion for a hearing to the Court of Appeals. They never objected to our 8 amended pleadings on that ground, in their motion for summary judgment, their judgment NOV.
Well, is your position that it need not be the proximate cause, or that it must be the proximate cause, the tangible?
It is our position, Judge, that the jury here found that it was the proximate cause. That issue is not before the court under the law or the facts of this case. Legally, this court said in sulfato that it has to be...
I don't want to know what the jury found. I would like to know what your position is on the law. Is the law...
Well, it's not my position. It's this court's unanimous position in sulfato.
I would like to know what your contention is. Does the use or non-use of tangible personal property have to be the proximate cause of the injury to meet the limited waiver of sovereign immunity under the Texas Tort Claims Act?
Under the language of the Act, the personal injuries have to be caused, but approximately caused by some use of the property. Under this court's interpretation in sulfato, the use of property has to be a contributing factor, has to be involved or included.
Thank you.
Okay. The cases that the state has cited to you on tangible property involve cases where the negligence was merely incidental to the injury, cases that involve no allegations of use approximately causing the injury, and cases where there was no negligence. The cases cited by the state on proximate cause are all summary judgment cases. Here we had a 6.5-week trial and 17 days of very careful jury deliberation, and a jury finding, which this court is bound by, that the property proximately caused her injury.
Excuse me, counsel, but are you splitting your opening with
yes,
the co-counsel?
Yes, we are, and it's time for me to end. If I could just say in ending that we urge this court to follow sulfato The Court of Appeals agrees, this court agrees, the state agrees, and we agree that Salcedo should be followed. If it's followed, Opal Petty should finally receive at least some compensation for her injuries. Thank you for your time.
Morning. I appreciate your accommodating my commitment to Dean Newton to speak at the law school in a little while. So, and I actually have a very few comments. I just basically want to address the false imprisonment issue. That was the issue that I dealt with in the brief, and some of the questions have come up with that. I'd like to point out that false imprisonment issue was specially accepted out of the pleadings back in October, 6 months before the trial. The judge sustained the false imprisonment special exception, and it went out. And we never, ever tried to bring it back at all. Now, in the jury argument, there were, in the presentation of the case, there were constitutional claims and there were tort claims. Constitutional claims were directed towards specific individuals, and they dealt with questions of whether the commitment was involuntary commitment or not, and whether it was a proper involuntary commitment with respect to the conditions that she was in, and whether it was a proper involuntary commitment with respect to the conditions that she was in. That constitutional question is different than a tort false imprisonment question. But in any respect, the jury resolved that. The jury did not deal, the jury basically, when it sorted out the questions on involuntary confinement and a negligent treatment, really held for us only on the negligent treatment and decided that she was mistreated and did not at all deal with any of the individual constitutional claims. So that's why there's some of this language about the confinement going on in the pleadings, is because there were constitutional issues at that time. But the jury dealt with it as a negligence case, very simple, and actually ruled against us or held against us in this verdict on the constitutional claims with respect to the kind of confinement. But we were very careful to make sure that this was not an allegation of the tort claim. Now, with respect to the two court hearings, of course, one of the elements of a false imprisonment claim is that there is no color of law, that there's no legal authority involved, and we didn't take that position in the trial. In fact, our witness said that it was proper for Ms. Petty probably to be confined for a few months because of the conflict that she was going through in the development of her life and with her parents and so on. That wasn't a dispute with us. The point was that the records reflect that after a few months, she should have gotten out. There was no doubt about that. With respect to the hearing, the second trial that Judge Gamage talked about in 1978, that was nothing. We proved that trial. That was nothing but a pro forma trial under a new statute to come into effect. She did not appear. Her attorney did not even talk to her. This is what we proved to the jury. Her attorney didn't even talk to her. In fact, her attorney didn't even look at her records. It was just pro forma commitment over there in San Angelo.
Under Texas law, a jury must determine before you can be confined. But then the release is left solely up to the judgment of the mental health regime.
That's right. That's right. And what had happened...
Under the new law, a jury has to... this had to be reviewed. Was that a one-shot deal in the 77 law, or is it periodically?
It was... what they were trying to do was to commit her under the 77 law. There was a requirement that, the state went ahead and committed people under the 77 law, and that's what this was. It basically, as we showed, just a pro forma of compliance with the 77.
Is that also a one-time affair, or does it have to be court reviewed?
It's supposed to be court reviewed. It's not, under the Mental Retardation Act, it's not court reviewed as it is under a mental illness statute. She started off in the system on the mental health side and was transferred over.
To the mental retardation,
without that hearing, without any hearing, and then 78, there's a pro forma hearing. But we're not, that question about the legality and so on, while we challenged that originally, and basically severed off in the class action as to what were the proper constitutional standards, wasn't really the issue with the trial here, and this was basically the damage action with respect to how Ms. Petty was treated. And we had constitutional claims and negligence claims. The jury held against us on the constitutional claims, but held for us on the negligence claims.
Any other questions?
Yes, sir. Mr. Harrington, you filed a motion to accelerate and advance this cause. I think the state did not have any objection to that, but with all the cases that we have pending here, is there any more reason to accelerate and advance the resolution of this cause over others we have pending?
I think the resolution, the answer to that question is really one of equity. Ms. Petty's lost basically her life to the institution, 51 years. Their own records show she shouldn't have been there. Her siblings all had families, all had children, all lived productive lives. And $250,000 isn't much compensation for that kind of loss. But it is something, and she is, at this point, 73 years old, and if she were to prevail, we'd like to have her get something out of the rest of her life.
Any other questions?
Question was asked earlier. If the argument is that state kept her longer than it should have, state says that's essentially a false imprisonment argument. What's your response?
Our response is that the problem was the way they treated her during the period of time that they kept her.
They should have kept her, but they should have treated her differently.
If they were going to keep her, they had to treat her differently. That's exactly right. We lost on that question about, we had to name specific individuals for the constitutional claim. We can't sue the state as an entity. And people that we were able to name, we had, of course, a lot of problem with dealing with 51 years of defendants and statute limitations. But our argument is that during that time that she was in the institution, regardless of whether she should have been there as a constitutional matter, they negligently treated her. And it was, they had her under control and they mistreated her in a negligent fashion during that time that she was there.
Even if the accommodations would have been equivalent to the finest hotel, food would have been gourmet food, would not the fact of their detaining her improperly constitute damages?
I think as a matter of constitutional law, that would probably be true. That would be a deprivation of due process. I think that would be true. In terms of what we were arguing here is that even given the bad conditions that existed, I think everybody acknowledges the bad conditions that existed during the time that she was there. We had Governor Shivers, the special commission, and all of that. Even in that situation, they could have done much better by her, and the reason they didn't do better by her was because of the way they were misusing these diagnostic tools that they had. We knew they employed her out there in that laundry all the time, the 34 years that she was there, because she was one of the most reliable employees they had. She showed up, did a good job. So she had those kinds of skills. And if they had given her the kind of treatment and the kind of training that they had available at that time, Opal Petty would not be a victim of this institutionalization that she now is after 51 years.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
It would have been criminal, it would have been deep negligence had St. Angelo State School discharged Ms. Petty because she scored a couple of points over some magical cutoff. We would probably be here on a negligent discharge. We'd probably be here on the accusation that they left her in the streets, that she was homeless, that she couldn't care for herself.
Why so?
Because the decision to not discharge her because of some magical score was made on a judgment call. It was made on the basis of what was available. This woman, by the time we have the Texas Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation in 1965, had been in the institution since 1934. Her family had long disappeared. In 1954, the records show that Austin State Hospital made some attempt to try to get the family to take her back, and they said they couldn't handle her. They weren't able to take care of her.
The argument, as I understand it, is not so much that she was not supposed to be there, but they did a very inadequate job while they had her there with available resources through the misuse of some diagnostic records.
Again, Your Honor, I don't think there's any indication of any injury. I think when you talk about institutionalization, what they proved at trial was that anybody who's in an institution is going to have certain deficits, a certain inability to do certain things. If you're in the Army, you're going to have a certain expectation, you're going to have a certain lack of something. And this is what they proved at trial, that as a result of being at Austin State Hospital, Ms. Petty came to depend on people to have her meals at a certain time, came to depend on people to provide her clothing. She didn't know how to go out and make a choice on clothing.
But the argument is that she would have thrived in that setting if she had been given the nurturing care that she should have received.
I don't think there was evidence to show that. I don't think there was evidence that showed that she was treated in any way different from any other person. And
the fact that you're treating everybody the same does not ask the question. The fact is, as I understand their argument, is that you, the state, did not do the job that the citizens expect a person in that condition that can thrive, that can understand, that they can be dependent on herself and make the choices independent of other people.
Okay, I don't think the evidence showed that, but if it did, I don't even think there was a causal connection again between use of this property and that particular problem. The evidence at best showed that there was a continuing need for additional funding and that the department and various people in the state were going out to get additional funding and that psychiatric services had changed over this period of time, and there was just this constant trying to make public psychiatric services better and better over the period of time, that Ms. Petty was not in any different situation than other patients, and that when they say she could have been habilitated better, they talk about this. There were several tests that Ms. Petty took. Some of them she scored below what we consider mental retardation now. Some she scored above them. Some of the tests were better suited for her than others, but the scoring changed dramatically. I mean, no matter what the test was, she scored sometimes above, sometimes below. It didn't pretty much follow the test. They talk about the Vineland test as being inappropriate because it only measures adaptive skills. There was never any evidence that the Vineland test was used for any other purpose, that there was any evidence that it was used to show IQ. There was no evidence to show that a decision to transfer her was made based on the Vineland test. And even if it were, as I said before, the standard at that time was that she could benefit from habilitation in a state school. And if the Vineland measures anything, it measures adaptive skills, ability to do things. And the whole program of the state school is based on habilitation, based on ability to do things. If you read in the record the descriptions of the programs provided to Ms. Petty at San Angelo State School, they don't sound at all like deprivation. In fact, when we were through with the trial, members of the jury wanted to go visit San Angelo State School because they were so impressed with the staff that had come to testify, with the things that the staff did for Ms. Petty, with the caring nature of what they did, with the art that they worked with her, the music that they worked with her, and just that the caring people that had actually worked with Ms. Petty.
Doesn't anyone who is deprived of their freedom develop some of the characteristics that you say she had, such as dependence on meals and ability to select clothes? I mean, if you're deprived of your freedom, by its very nature, you develop dependence.
I believe you do, Your Honor, and it doesn't even have to be a deprivation of freedom in that sense. It could be being in the Army. It could be being, you know, in some situation where you live with a large group of people and you do things according to a clock that has some other motivation behind it other than your own personal choice.
Ms. Hunter, how are the Ms. Petty's next friends related to her?
Her nephew and his wife.
And when was the first time shown in the record of the trial of this case, when was the first time that any of her family relations, manifested an interest in having her released from state institutions?
There was evidence that they went to a family reunion, I believe it was in 84 or early 85, and heard that they had this relative, they happened to live in San Angelo, that they had this relative that might be in a state school near San Angelo, and when they came back from the family reunion, they went to the state school and looked her up. Ms. Petty had siblings who were contemporaneous with her, who were alive. There was evidence in the record that her brother visited her on different occasions over the years. He didn't ever institute any kind of an effort to get her out of the state school. She could have, that kind of effort could have resulted in release if anybody wanted to take custody over it or help her. My time is up, I guess.
It's under the same jury that was so impressed with the services provided by the state school in San Angelo. It's also the jury that awarded Ms. Petty $500,000, isn't it?
I think the jury had a difficult, I think the jury decided that something must be wrong if somebody was in a state institution for 51 years. But I don't think...
Even under the best of circumstances, 51 years of her life, the trial court reduced that to $250,000, no prejudgment interest. And if she recovers that, then she is rewarded for this 51 years, less than $5,000 for each year.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the state is punished for trying to take care of someone who had no one else to take care of him.
State is punished.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument and the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.